Confusion. You can find me on Studio B every Thursday, 1700 hours Pacific Time. That's 8 p.m. Eastern. No topic taboo, no subject too strange. I strive to take a neutral standpoint during the dissection of the topic at hand. That's Reality Extraction with Mr. Rowe on Revolution Radio.
Oscar's freeze. That's your cerebral cortex looking for an answer it doesn't have.
See? Even your brain knows you're screwed.
Your blood is filling with adrenaline right now. Whether you know it or not, your heart's beating fast. It's getting a little harder to breathe. The neurobiological system is telling it to run, but your knees are too weak to move.
Fear is not real. The only place that fear can exist is in our thoughts of the future. It is a product of our imagination, causing us to fear things that do not at present and may not ever exist. That is near insanity. Do not misunderstand me. Danger is very real, but fear is a choice. We are all telling ourselves a story.
Listening to Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. 100% listener supported radio. Reporting the danger. Unafraid. Right here, where information never sleeps. Revolution. Revolution. Radio.
Good morning and welcome to Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. It's time to slip back the curtains and savor the beauty of this fine Sunday morning. Settle down on the chaise lawn with a warming mug of happy hellos and a plateful of wondrous wishes as we enjoy a metaphorical dive into the pool of poetic peregrinations and gallivanting geekery. Welcome to the weird wonder that is Willow's Weekend World.
Good morning and welcome from a beautiful United Kingdom. My name is Willow Andreas, and also known as Sorry Sunflower, in the Revolution Radio at freedomslips.org chat room. And this is the Sunday, the 18th of June, 2023 edition of Willow's Weekend World. And before I get started with telling you what's happening on today's show, I just want to wish all the fathers out there a happy Father's Day. I hope you're having a lovely Sunday so far. And enjoying all the socks and gifts and bits and pieces that have been given to you. No, I hope you're having a lovely day, guys, and anyone who's in a fathering capacity, wishing you all a wonderful, wonderful Father's Day. And yeah, going to tell you now what's happening on today's show. Excuse me, I've just got to mute. Note to self, don't stuff down your breakfast only 20 minutes before the show. It's not a good idea. How many times have you heard that, though, from me? Oh, I shouldn't have done that. I don't learn, do I? It's just turned 2 o'clock in the afternoon over here in the UK. And just want to say a big, big thank you to Gerber, who's just finished his second stint of the weekend over on Studio A. A big, big thank you to all the hosts here at the station for everything you all do. It's truly appreciated indeed. And to producers and moderators, sometimes have a few challenges to tackle, but they do so promptly and with smiles on their faces. A big, big thank you to them. Huge outpourings of gratitude as well, and lots of love and hugs to the team that I am humbled and honoured to be a part of, a team that bends over backwards and just that little bit more to ensure that this station remains on air for as close to 24/7 as we can get it, which is most of the time. Also, huge outpourings of gratitude as well, and lots of love and hugs to Liz Ringley, who continues to represent so, so much to the station. And to the individual whose prescience, whose vision, whose drive convinced him it was a necessity to construct this vehicle for free speech, which took its maiden journey 12 and a half years ago now. And, yep, we're just under 6 months away from Hawk's baby becoming an adolescent. So, it'll be interesting, as I say, getting through the first 13 years. And in those past nearly 13 years, 12 and a half, 13 years, the station has become a global family of like-minded souls, of kindred spirits, who have gravitated towards each other and indeed been reunited with each other in certain cases as well. And we miss, as I say, every single time, we miss him every single day. Every single one of us misses him every single day. A big, big thank you to Mike Ringley, to Nighthawk, for this amazing gift of a station. Also, much missed. This is what happens when you eat too, if you just stuff things down too quickly before the, you know, show, you sort of get this. We'll get there. Also much missed every single day as well. I'm looking at his photographs. I say this huge outpourings of gratitude and lots of love and hugs and kisses to my late other half, Briarios, for everything that he continues to represent in my life and always, always will. Thank you very, very much indeed, my love. And also huge outpourings of gratitude as well, as and lots of love and hugs and kisses to some very, very special loved ones in my life. They know exactly who they are. They know exactly who they are. And why are you making strange noises at me? Why are you spitting at me? Hopefully you did you hear that on air? That was weird. Okay. I'll keep a listen for that. And to the musician as well. Yeah. Yeah. That's what I think you feel the same. Yes. And last but not least, folks, huge outpourings of gratitude to you amazing listeners. We do this for you. We wouldn't be able to do this without you either, folks. Totally symbiotic relationship. It's your kindness, your love, your support, your generosity that enables us to continue providing you with such a wide variety of shows hosted by fantastic individuals from all around the world on a close to 24/7 basis. That's very same kindness, love, generosity and support that enables us to do so on a commercial-free basis. Yep, there are promos here at the tops and sometimes bottoms of the hour, but they are restricted to station business only. Station business, station shows, station information. Also, that very same kindness, love, support and generosity enables us to continue providing you with the archives for free as well. And again, we hope that's going to be the case for the foreseeable future, but that's going to remain so. We don't take your support for granted, folks. We do appreciate just how challenging these times are for so many right now. And you're still supporting us through these times. So I know I'm speaking on behalf of everybody here. And I do know that we are all grateful to every single one of you. And we hope that you can feel that gratitude enveloping you every single day. A big, big thank you to you all. Now, as mentioned, we are entirely listener supported. If you'd like to help us out and you're not sure how, what I recommend you do is you visit our website, which you can reach using one of three URLs. There's www.revolution.radio. That's www.revolution.radio. www.freedomslips.net. That's www.freedomslips.net. And www.freedomslips.org. That's www.freedomslips.org. You will arrive upon this same website of ours, which has been established and lovingly maintained by the amazing Monster 383. So when you see him in the chat room, folks, or any of my fellow managers, please say a big, big thanks to them, because they do a sterling job of making sure everything's up and running. And let's just say a big, big thanks to them. And the place you need to explore is a donations option. The donations option is six for long on the nav bar. You click on that, that opens up in a new tab for you. Details all the methods bar one of supporting the station. We've got Patreon, we've got Donor Box, we've got direct payment North America only. I'll repeat those: Patreon, Donor Box and direct payment North America only. All three have monthly support options available with them. You need to be a patron in order to do so on Patreon, by the way, and you can become a patron either by selecting this option here on the donations page or returning to the home page, where you'll find it sitting pretty in pink near the top, If you've got a light background, if you've got a dark background like me, it's leaf green. It's very pleasant. Donor Box is the alternative to PayPal. It's international in scope. It's easy to use. Again, you can set up something for a monthly support, or you can use it whenever you are able to use it. Direct payment North America only applies if you happen to live in the US or Canada and have a credit or debit card. Yep, same options available there as with Donor Box. We accept three different types of cryptocurrency, folks. They are Bitcoin, Ethereum, and Bitcoin Cash. I'll repeat those. Bitcoin, Ethereum, and Bitcoin Cash. There are QR codes on the screen. You point your devices at them. You do your thing. And last but not least, of the snail mail details, folks. Yep, we still accept checks or money orders, and they are to be made payable to Revolution Radio. That's two separate words. Revolution spelled R-E-V-O-L-U-T-I-O-N. I'll repeat that. It's R-E-V. O-L-U-T-I-O-N, and radio is spelt R-A-D-I-O. I'll repeat that. It's R-A-D-I-O. How very strange. I've just had a waft I think it's a body wash or shower gel under my nose of some description. It smells like a male one. I'm trying to identify it at the minute. How strange. Carrying on. Once the checks and money orders are maybe once you've filled in the details, you're wondering who you need to post them to. Well, you need to post them to the wonderful lady horse, Terry Ackerman. Terry spelled T-E-R-R-Y. I'll repeat that, T-E-R-R-Y. And Ackerman is spelled A-C-K-E-R-M-A-N. I'll repeat that, A-C-K-E-R-M-A-N. The mailing address is 1793, that's 1793 North Eden. Eden spelled E-D-O-N Road. And that's Allen, A-L-L-E-N, Michigan, M-I, 49227. So checks or money orders made payable to Revolution Radio are then to be mailed to the wonderful lady horse, Terry Ackerman, at 1793 North Eden Road. And that's Allen, Michigan, 49227. Those details can also be found on the main homepage. I've returned there. You can advertise on the station's website as well, folks. So if you've got a product or company you'd like to get out there, you'd like it to be seen by plenty, which it would be on our website, but cost is a bit of an issue. Well, for $25 a month, you can advertise on the station's website. And for further details, you need to contact the GM himself, A Mad Painter, using the following email address, which is themadpainter13@yahoo.com. That's themadpainter13@yahoo.com. I'll spell out that first segment for you. It's T-H-E. M-A-D-P-A-I-N-T-E-R 1-3. And I'll repeat that for you. It's T-H-E-M-A-D-P-A-I-N-T-E-R 1-3@yahoo.com. All lowercase in format, by the way. We've got dedicated call to listen numbers for both studios A and B. They're numbers you just call. You just listen. You don't have to participate. You don't have to speak. But we do heartily recommend that you speak to your cell phone or landline service providers. There are costs involved with calling those numbers, so please call them first. Once you've done so, once you're happy with what you've been told, the dedicated call to listen number for Studio A is 641-793-6370. So for Studio A, it's 641-793-6370. And the dedicated call to listen number for Studio B is 641-793-2531. I'll repeat that for Studio B. It's 641-793-2531. Check with your providers about those costs first, though, okay? Essential. And last but not least, folks, are the archives. Free to access will be for the foreseeable. You can reach them either by selecting the archives option, which is third along on the navbar, or going direct to its URL, which is www.revolutionradioarchives.com. That's www.revolutionradioarchives.com. And the details you need to access the wonders that await you within are the username and the password, both of which are lowercase and case sensitive in format. The username is Rev Radio. That's Rev Radio. I'll spell that for you. It's R-E-V-R-A-D-I-O. And I'll repeat that for you. It's R-E-V-R-A-D-I-O. And the password is ROX exclamation mark. That's ROX exclamation mark. I'll spell that. It's R-O-C-K-S exclamation mark. And I'll repeat that. It's R-O-C-K-S exclamation mark. Don't forget the exclamation mark, folks, because without it, you won't be able to get in. I omitted it once, and guess what happened? Nothing, because I'd omitted it. Remember it, you'd be perfectly fine. But again, a big, big thank you to everyone for your continued support. We are truly, truly grateful indeed. Thank you. So what's happening on today's show? Well, I'm going to wander into the chat room shortly to say a big hello to everybody in there and make sure everybody is okay. And then we're going to be geeking out good and proper today. We're starting with the geek headlines, which, of course, comes courtesy of a Nexus of Nerdom. This is Io9 Gizmodo's Friday's morning spoilers. The seven articles for your delectation today. We're starting with one from the Den of Geek, which has been deferred from last Sunday's show, Venturing into the World of Cinema, the Den's estimation of what it considers to be the most underappreciated sci-fi movies from the 1970s. And I probably remember most of them. Remembering with the Den of remaining rather, and remembering probably. Yeah, I'd say both apply. Remaining with the Den of Geek, we're taking a trip in the TARDIS and temporarily traversing into the Hooniverse for a grand debunking of some of the show's more unusual rumours. Indeed. From Kotaku, we're journeying into the world of gaming to find out how a 16-year-old gamer has become the fastest typist in the world. A ridiculous speed, I can tell you that. From Gizmodo, we're heading into that galaxy somewhere far, far away and settling in the Star Wars universe to celebrate the 40th anniversary of the Return of a Jedi, with Gizmodo's estimation of what it considers to be 40 of the most powerful moments in the film. Returning to the Den of Geek, also returning to the world of cinema to explore the somewhat bumpy history of translating successful toy brands into the medium of movies. Still with the Den of Geek, we're boldly going where no man has gone before and settling in the Star Trek universe to find out how the Captain James T. Kirk we will see in the second season of Star Trek Strange New Worlds will be boldly different from the James T. Kirk we have seen before. And finally, remaining with the Den of Geek for the conclusion to this weekend's Geek Out, we're returning to the world of cinema for the Den's thoughts on 15 action movies it considers to be ahead of their time. So, indeed, got a lot to get through. Heading into the chat room now to say a big hello to everybody in there. Make sure everybody is okay. If I can find the right tab, I've got so many tabs open. There you are. Let's see who is in the chat room. Gavin's in the chat room. I'm going to go up to the top of the hour. Gavin's in the chat room as well as Malaya. Comet is in as well as Fleeced. Futurist is in as well as the voice of the overnights at the weekend and sometimes during the week as well. Gerber, he's in the chat room too. I'm just, as I say, I'm just going to make sure I haven't missed anybody out because it's moving a bit quickly in there. No, I haven't. It's all fine. But if you want to come in and join us, folks, please do come in and join us. It'd be good to see you in there. The more, the merrier. Be good to see you. So, we have got the geek headlines coming up now. Heading over to the Nexus of Nerdom, this is Io9 Gizmodo for this one. This is Friday's morning spoilers. it was posted up, Friday. Compiled by Gordon Jackson and James Whitbrook. I think it's going to be quite a packed one, this one. Headlined, Mortal Kombat 2 has found some of its biggest bads. Plus, The Mandalorian's Giancarlo Esposito joins the cast of Universal's next Mystery Monster movie. So check out a veritable smorgasbord of Barbie clips. Doctor Who adds another young hero to its cast. Netflix sets a date for its Chicken Run sequel. Plus, Mads Mikkelsen discusses the chances of ever coming back to Hannibal. And some major Superman and Lois cast shakeups are on the way. To me, my spoilers, and we start with Untitled Universal Monster Movie. That's a good name for a film, isn't it? Deadline reports Giancarlo Esposito has joined Melissa Barrera, Alicia Weir, Dan Stevens, Kevin Durand, Catherine Newton, Angus Cloud and Will Catlett in the cast of Matt Bettinelli Olpin and Tyler Gillett's mysterious new monster movie at Universal. Mortal Kombat 2 is up next, so Deadline also reports Martin Ford, Desmond Chiam, Anna Tu Nguyen and Damon Herriman have joined the cast of the upcoming Mortal Kombat sequel as Shao Kahn, Edenian King Gerard, Queen Sindel and the Netherrealm demon Quan Chi respectively. Mortal Kombat Legends Cage Match is the next one up. So, relatedly, IGN has our first look at the animated Johnny Cage movie, in which the actor-turned-martial artist must rescue his co-star, Dirty Dancing's Jennifer Grey, voicing herself, from a sinister secret society plotting a nefarious scheme. Excuse me, I've just got to mute a moment. Note to self, please don't eat breakfast that quickly before a show. Come on. Barbie is next. So three new clips from Barbie see the living doll plan the ultimate house party, encounter the bizarre Barbie about her flat feet, and taking part in a high-speed car chase. Yeah, I'm sure Barbie was like that when I had Barbie dolls. Not. Chicken Run Dawn of a Nugget was next. So Aardman has also released a quick teaser for the Chicken Run sequel premiering December 15th on Netflix. Superman and Lois, Deadline reports neither Dylan Walsh, Emmanuel Chikri, Eric Valdez, Indy Navarrete, Wole Parks and Taylor Buck or Sophia Hasmick have been asked to return for the fourth season of Superman and Lois at the CW. Good grief, that is a shake-up. Whoa. Doctor Who is up next, and meanwhile, Spoiler TV reports 14-year-old Lenny Rush has joined the cast of Doctor Who's 14th season as Morris, new companion of Shooty Gatwa's incoming Doctor. I think he's going to have three companions, actually, by the sounds of it. I mean, he's not only going to have Ruby Sunday, but he's also got Mel Bush as well coming back to join him. So it's, I think it's going to be a full TARDIS again. Clone High is up next. So according to comic book, Clone High has been officially renewed for a third season at Max. Hannibal is next. So in conversation with Deadline, Mads Mikkelsen stated there's still a chance for a fourth season of Hannibal, though conceded the show's cast and crew are running out of time to find the series a new home. So here's a quote. Always a chance. There's always a chance. It's all about finding a home for it. Of course, we're running out of time. We can't wait 20 years. But in the next couple of years, if someone finds a home, we're all ready to take it up again. And finally, as the Santa Clauses, Disney Plus has released a new promotional image for the second season of the Santa Clauses on Instagram. Indeed, they have. So anyway, I'll just share this in the chat room. I'm going to have a quick look at Kotaku as well. Will you please stay out the way? Thank you very much. Stop moving around on the desk. Stop it. There we go. I'll just post that there in both chat rooms. Geek. Thank you, please. We're geeking out good and proper. Let's have a look at the I'll tell you who I think I've worked out who the dedicated focus is going to be next week as well, Fleeced. I said it, I wasn't sure if it was going to be this one or not, but I think it's going to be. And you know what? It's just completely. This is awful when this happens. Oh, yeah, I've just remembered. I'll tell you in a minute, once I've forgotten it again. We'll have a quick look at Kotaku's headlines as well. 40-plus weird vintage video game ads we can't stop thinking about. Twitch mega streamer XQC signed by gambling company for $100 million. 8 games to play this weekend. Why Starfield 30 FPS space sandwiches? Oh. Why is Starfield 30 FPS? Okay, game space sandwiches probably. You could have phrased that a bit better. Diablo 4 fans think it's stingy with XP, so Blizzard is promising changes. Someone at Nintendo snuck Pride Month into the Switch's eShop. Diablo 4 really needs one more skill slot. Let's rank all the Spider-Man games from worst to best. I think we've done this one before. Diablo 4 devs say future update will fix annoying gems. Final Fantasy 16 devs list their top three FF games, and the top one is surprising fans. And Diablo 4 player can't believe what just perma killed his 172-hour droid. Oh, druid, rather. Not droid. If I've got time for any of these, I'll go back to them, but I probably won't. Because we're going to start the geek out proper now. We're heading to the Den of Geek for this article deferred from last week's show, authored by Don Kay, posted up on May the 20th. And we're going back in time to the 1970s for this one, folks. And I can probably remember most of these from the first time round. Yep, this is it. Yeah, the most underrated sci-fi movies of the 1970s. And he says the 1970s was a crazy, wonderful time for sci-fi cinema. Then Star Wars came along and ruined everything. Well, I wouldn't say it ruined everything. I'd just say it enhanced it. But anyway, carrying on. So if the 1950s was a decade in which science fiction cinema began to mature and evolve, and the 1960s was the era where it started to experiment and stretch in new directions, then the 1970s was the period when the genre more or less went batshit insane. The movies of the era continued to touch on socially and globally relevant themes, a trend that began 20 years earlier, while also continuing the literary pedigree and even more progressive concerns of a decade prior. But they did so in ever weirder ways, taking big swings, and often steep plunges as well, as many of the films of the decade aimed high, but lacked the resources to match their ambitions. Still, even the clunkier efforts of the 70s had their charms, and the creative success stories touched nerves in ways that the films of the previous decades hadn't quite achieved. But almost none of the movies of this turbulent decade garnered the kind of critical approval lavished upon other genres at that time, with sci-fi still considered a lesser cinematic arena than more upscale categories. Some of the era's output has been reappraised since then, however, and we'd venture that the genre was at its unbridled best in terms of imagination and creative freedom then. Well, at least until 1977, when a little movie called Star Wars came along and made the studios realise that there was box office gold in that secluded little sci-fi valley, and moved in with big budgets and armies of development execs. We can debate the ramifications of that until the sun itself goes supernova. But in the meantime, here are two dozen of the 1970s most underrated and signature sci-fi movies for you to bend your mind with. You're welcome. It says two dozen, it's supposed to be 15, isn't it? Oh no, 24. Oh, there's only 24 of them, okay. First up is Colossus, the Forbidden Project from 1970. Well, no, I wouldn't remember that one, but you know, because that was the year I was born, so unless I happen to be stuck in front of a screen to watch it, I don't know. So if you think AI is bad news, wait until you get a load of Colossus, the supercomputer built by the brilliant Dr. Charles Forbin, played by Eric Braeden, that is supposed to control the United States' defense systems and is impervious to attack. Well, when Colossus comes online, it does exactly what it's programmed to do, and then links up with its previously undisclosed Soviet counterpart Guardian, with the two machines declaring themselves in charge of the entire world. Sort of like the old Star Trek episode, The Ultimate Computer on Massive Steroids, Colossus is genuinely gripping as the coldly analytical Dr. Forbin begins to break down from the strain of trying to get his all-powerful technological genie back in the bottle, with terrifying results. You just switch it off, don't you? Just take out the plug. Then again, you wouldn't have a movie, would you? Briskly directed by Joseph Sargent and written by James Bridges, Colossus was based on a novel by D.F. Jones. Pity we never got to film versions of Jones's two sequels, in which a cult grows around Colossus, who is eventually deactivated and then rebooted when the Earth is threatened by an invasion from Mars. Next up is Beneath the Planet of the Apes from 1970. Although the original came out in 1968, the Apes franchise was one of the key sci-fi series of the 1970s, and in fact, the first to tell one complete story over the course of five films. Escape from the Planet of the Apes from 1971 and Conquest of the Planet of the Apes from 1972 are generally considered the best of the sequels. But the special charm of the first follow-up, Beneath, is that the entire movie is out of its mind from start to finish. Forced to write around star Charlton Heston, who agreed to only to come back for a cameo, the filmmakers sent astronaut Brent, played by James Franciscus, to find out what's happened to Heston's Colonel Taylor. He ends up on the same future Earth, where he meets a familiar society of intelligent apes, as well as a new underground race of telepathic human mutants who worship a bomb that can destroy the world. The whole thing ends with apes, humans and mutants killing each other off, with Heston reappearing just in time to detonate the bomb. Never has the end of the world been such bizarre off its rocker fun. Next up is the Andromeda Strain. From 1971, which of course was frequently referenced during a recent global event. I do vaguely remember it. I can't remember the last time I watched it though. It was probably the 90s, I think. Oh, sorry, I'm just making myself a bit more comfortable here. So a small town in New Mexico where all the residents are dead, except for a baby in the town drunk, is where Robert Wise's tense adaptation of Michael Crichton's novel begins. A team of four top scientists is assembled in a lab deep underground when they discover that the town was wiped out by a microscopic alien organism brought back from space by an unmanned satellite. If the incredibly lethal, ever-mutating organism escapes, all life on Earth could be threatened. Wise, of course, directed The Day the Earth Stood Still from 1951 and later Star Trek The Motion Picture in 1979, so he knows his way around large-scale sci-fi concepts. Crichton was years away from writing his biggest novel ever, Jurassic Park, but the idea of the smallest building blocks of life bringing catastrophe to the world was on his mind even back then. The cast of character actors brings a realism and immediacy to the proceedings. Interestingly, the character of Dr. Levitt, played by Kate Reid, was switched from male to female for the movie, and no one back then got themselves tied up in knots about it. Next up is THX 1138 from 1971. George Lucas always said that he set out to make little art films with his friends, but this is perhaps the one example of him actually doing that. The man who created the Star Wars juggernaut began his directing career with his expansion of a student film he made while attending USC. Robert Duvall stars as the title character, who lives in a future underground totalitarian society where everyone is forced to take drugs to suppress all emotions and are kept under control by robotic police. The inhibition of emotions proves problematic, however, when THX-1138 falls in love with LUH-3417, played by Maggie McCombie. Lucas's bleak, sterile view of a dystopian future is about as far as one can get from the lived-in, rough-and-tumble Star Wars universe. But the idea of a heavy-handed fascist government controlling everyone's lives certainly rears its head in both properties. Narratively, THX-1138 plods along on thin, derivative ground, but Lucas's creation of, and immersion in, this eerie world is complete and persuasive. A flop upon release, THX-1138 has since gained cult classic status, but the filmmaker behind it has not really been heard of since. Next up is The Amiga Man from 1971. Yeah, this is where Charlton Heston was in everything, wasn't he? It's hard to think about 70s sci-fi and not summon up an image of Charlton Heston. Not only did he star in the first two Apes movies, but he top-lined several more genre outings throughout the rest of the decade, one of which is this semi-iconic entry. The second of three movies, so far, to be based on Richard Matheson's landmark novel I Am Legend, this one wanders the farthest afield from the source text, replacing Matheson's vampires with albino-skinned mutants, although a biological plague, artificially created in the case of this movie, is responsible for both. In The Amiga Man, Heston's Robert Neville is a scientist who injects himself with an experimental vaccine just before society collapses, making himself not just immune, but possibly the saviour of what's left of humanity. In the meantime, he stalks the mutants during the day, and they chase him around at night, which makes for an action-oriented, occasionally creepy B-movie that lacks the subtext and nuance of Matheson's book. It's still one of our favourites from the era, though, with Heston in fine square-jawed form and Anthony Zerb, an effective mutant leader. Next up is Silent Running from 1972. Even back in the 1970s, environmental catastrophe and climate change was on the minds of filmmakers, including visual effects legend Douglas Trumbull, who made his directorial debut with this effort and brought his usual visual razzle-dazzle to the table. A permanently perplexed Bruce Dern stars as Freeman, get it, an ecologist on board one of eight domed spaceships containing the last plant life salvaged from Earth before all flora on the planet inexplicably died. When the crews are ordered to destroy the domes and return home, Freeman hatches a plan to save his dome and Earth's last remaining greenery. Dern's hippie-ish Freeman is a bit hard to latch onto, and the movie can be heavy-handed, but Trumbull's assured direction and special effects still make this a compelling and ultimately moving watch. It's all interesting also to note that Freeman's three droid helpers, Huey, Dewey and Louie, were a direct influence on R2-D2 5 years later in Star Wars. Next is The Crazies from 1973. The Crazies was written and directed by George A. Romero during the strange twilight phase between his feature debut, 1968's Night of the Living Dead, and its blockbuster sequel, 1979's Dawn of the Dead. During that period, Romero experimented wildly, turning out one authentic masterpiece, Martin, and several other interesting titles, most of which did not get wide distribution. One of those is this, in which a military bioweapon gets loose in a small town and turns all the residents into homicidal maniacs. The satirical edge that Romero brought fully to the forefront in Dawn gets a shakedown cruise here, as local town officials, the military and the federal government are either seen as incompetent, venal or both, while the tormented townspeople are the unwitting victims of the catastrophe unfolding around them. While the budget doesn't quite match Romero's aims and some of the acting is less than top-notch, The Crazies is chilling, both in its continued relevancy and its bleak outlook. Next up is Soylent Green from 1973, much talked about for very good reason. Yet more ecological catastrophe is a driving force behind one of the 1970s most iconic sci-fi entries, with noted conservative Chuck Heston coming out in this film against both rampant population growth and the destruction of the environment. Unfortunately, as the film opens, it's too late, with New York City now home to more than 40 million residents, food and housing shortages rampant, and societal collapse seemingly seconds away. We probably all know by now the solution that the corporate elites who run this world come up with to ensure a steady supply of food, but it's still an effectively chilling moment when Heston's detective comes upon the answer himself. Also powerful is Edward G. Robinson's death scene in a so-called suicide parlour, where he is put to sleep while watching vast IMAX-like images of towering trees, clear lakes, and unblemished sunsets. Like other films of the time, Soylent Green uses a metaphorical hammer to get its point across, but with Earth on track for disaster even as we speak, the film is more prescient than ever. Next up is Westworld from 1973. Yeah, I've seen it once. Very good film. Here's where it started, folks. Written and directed by Michael Crichton. Yes, that Michael Crichton. He was a director too. Westworld is set in an amusement park of the future called Delos. There, high-paying customers can enjoy life in recreations of the old American Old West, medieval Europe, or ancient Rome, with lifelike androids on hand to kill, F or entertain, until the androids have had enough. Of course, Jonathan Nolan and Lisa Joy spun this simple premise out into an expensive, hopelessly enigmatic and complicated TV series. But Crichton keeps it simple and relatively low-key here. James Brolin and Richard Benjamin are the hapless pals who get more than they bargained for on their vacation, while Yul Brynner is genuinely creepy as an android version of his classic Magnificent Seven persona. He was a good actor, Yul Brynner. Still great fun to watch, this Westworld arguably says more about dangerous technology and corporate greed in 90 minutes than Nolan and Joy did in four seasons. Next up is Sleeper from 1973. I'm not a big fan of Woody Allen, but it has to be mentioned, it's part of the article. Woody Allen's one and only full-length sci-fi film, although genre elements appear in sections of Everything You Always Wanted to Know About Sex But Were Afraid to Ask, remains one of his funniest early efforts. Allen stars as Miles Monroe, a Manhattan jazz musician and health food store owner who is accidentally put into deep freeze for 200 years after an operation goes wrong. He wakes up to find himself in a totalitarian future, where he becomes part of a plot to overthrow a dictator known only as the leader. This is a judgment-free zone. We get it if anything involving Allen is a no-go, says the author. But at the same time, Sleeper is a delightful homage to both sci-fi movies and the landmark slapstick comedy of greats like Buster Keaton or Charlie Chaplin. The jokes and physical gags come at such a rapid-fire pace that a first watch of the movie will likely leave you breathless with laughter. Coming out amidst the era's mostly serious or self-serious genre outings, Sleeper affectionately makes fun of its many tropes. At the very least, Isaac Asimov adored it. Next is Zardoz from 1974. Where you've got him wearing weird sort of underwear, haven't you, in this? Yes. Here's where we strike 70s sci-fi gold. This is Sean Connery and, just about to get to that. A self-serious movie that actually satirises itself as well. From a middle-aged Sean Connery in a red diaper and thigh-high boots with a giant floating stone head that vomits out scores of guns, to eager acolytes. You can see NRA types getting all weak in the knees just at the thought. This is the author saying this. John Borman's Zardoz is both glorious excess and incoherent rubbish, and is one of those movies that you just have to see to believe. You may not enjoy every minute, but a lot of them will be winners. The former James Bond plays Zed, an exterminator who hunts and kills his fellow savages, known as Brutals, in a post-apocalyptic wasteland on the orders of a stone godhead, Zardoz. Sneaking aboard Zardoz, Zed discovers that it's controlled by a telepathic society known as the Eternals. Not those Eternals, who are going insane because they're immortal and bored and want to die. Zed is happy to help, but at first he impregnates one of them and also absorbs all human knowledge into his head from the AI that runs the Eternals' estate. If all that doesn't send you running to watch this right now, nothing will. Next up is Darkstar from 1974. Four men and one dead but still conscious captain go slowly mad aboard their spaceship, some 20 years into a deep space mission, to destroy unstable planets with intelligent bombs so that colonists will not land on them. Oh yeah, there's also an alien beach ball on board. From its beginnings as a student film at USC, Darkstar was eventually expanded into a low-budget feature film that served ingeniously as both genuine science fiction and sharp-edged satire, all done on less money than it takes to feed the crew lunch on your average Marvel movie. Of course, this is achieved primarily by two men. Director John Carpenter, making the first film in what would become a legendary career, and the late Dan O'Bannon, who wrote the script and played the incredibly annoying and inept Pinback. Darkstar is historic in that respect, as it launched the filmmakers who went on to create, respectively, Halloween and Alien, and many others. But on its own terms, it's a delightfully weird mind f of a movie. No one saw it when it came out, but what are you waiting for? Next up is Phase 4 from 1974. The sole film directed by Saul Bass, the genius main titles and poster designer behind sequences like the opening titles of Psycho, Phase 4 was a dud when it came out and was difficult to see for many years. It has since been rediscovered and hailed as a low-profile gem of its time, with its psychedelic sequences and enigmatic ending lending credence to the idea that this is one of the decade's more visionary sci-fi outings. Michael Murphy and Nigel Davenport star as two scientists who are trying to understand the rapid new evolution of ants following a mysterious cosmic event. It soon becomes clear that the ants are going to outpace humanity itself in terms of advancement, and that they already have plans in motion for us. Plans beyond our ability to understand. Eerie but somewhat impenetrable, Phase 4 is cerebral entertainment that asks, in its own way, some provocative questions. Next is The Stepford Wives from 1975. Sadly, it seems as if this excellent thriller, based on a novel by Rosemary's Baby author Ira Levin and directed by British icon Brian Forbes, has been overshadowed in recent years by the disastrous 2004 comedic remake starring Nicole Kidman and Matthew Broderick. Then again, perhaps not. In the decades since this has come out, the term Stepford Wife has become ingrained in the zeitgeist, with everyone knowing pretty much exactly what it means. Even more chilling is the fact that, as far-right Republicans do their best to snatch away a woman's control over her private medical choices, the Stepford Wives, this is the article saying this, okay, so don't go throwing things at me. Thank you. The Stepford Wives, like its thematic cousins such as The Handmaid's Tale, is still relevant today. The metaphor in both the book and the movie may be right on the nose, but the idea of replacing free-thinking women of agency with submissive, obedient androids probably holds some appeal to certain political factors in this land. The film itself is both funny and unsettling, with Catherine Ross and Paul Apprentice as the only two women in the town not yet replaced, and Patrick O'Neill suitably oily as the man who developed the tech to do it. Next is A Boy and His Dog from 1975. The only feature film based on a story, novella in this case, by science fiction giant Harlan Ellison, A Boy and His Dog relates the story of Vic, played by Don Johnson, a feral young man who wanders the post-nuclear landscape of the United States in search of food and women with his dog Blood, voiced by Tim McIntyre, who has been genetically engineered and can now communicate telepathically with his human. But when Vic is lured by a seductive woman named Quilla June to an underground civilization known as Topeka, the relationship and lives of both the boy and his dog are threatened. Directed by LQ Jones, A Boy and His Dog is simply too weird to be anything but a cult film, although Jones gets lots of mileage out of performances from Johnson, Suzanne Benton as Quilla June, Jason Robards and especially McIntyre's voicing of Blood. Ellison's pitch black humour was too much for some at the time of the film's release, with both the story and especially its ending called out as misogynist. But it fits perfectly with Ellison's bleak vision of human society and morals following a devastating war. Next is Rollerball from 1975. Yeah, I remember this. In the not-too-distant future, the world is run entirely by massive corporations, which keep the public distracted with televised sports such as Rollerball, a violent game played on skates and motorcycles that is meant to promote the idea of teamwork rather than individual accomplishment. But when star player Jonathan E., played by James Caan, becomes too popular for the corporation's liking, they make the game even more vicious in an effort to force him out or get him killed. Out of all the films on this list, Rollerball nowadays might have aged the worst. While the actual game sequences are tremendously exciting and brutal, they ironically work against director Norman Jewison's stated intention to decry the increasing violence of contact sports. But the rest of the movie is even worse, with Caan doing his best, and not always succeeding, to weave his way through a script that's tedious, clunky and overwrought. The premise is sound and can be found in the DNA of properties like The Hunger Games, but the execution is flubbed. Next up is Shivers from 1975. I was going to say, I'm wondering if this is Cronenberg looking at it. Following two early films made while he was still a student at the University of Toronto, Shivers was David Cronenberg's first real commercially released feature and immediately set the tone for the early phase of a legendary director's career. While his other two films released in the 1970s, Rabid and The Brood, could probably make this list as well, Shivers was a template for the sci-fi body horror themes, concepts and visuals that permeated his remarkable initial run of movies. An apartment complex in Montreal comes under siege when a parasite developed by a scientist to unleash human beings' sexual impulses escapes into the building, turning the entire population into a mindless horde of horny, homicidal psychopaths. As you might imagine, things do not improve from there. All the Cronenberg trademarks, intense gore, violent sexual urges, the corruption of the human body via artificial means, are present, and even if Cronenberg would refine his approach in years to come, the primal power of the images here still packs a punch today. And next up is The Man Who Fell to Earth from 1976. Though late great musician and elevated human being David Bowie takes on his first lead role in a movie in Nicholas Roeg's trippy, head-spinning adaptation of Walter Tevis's 1963 novel. Like Roeg's standout horror film Don't Look Now from a few years earlier, The Man Who Fell to Earth plays with linear time and the perception of reality as it tells the story of Thomas Jerome Newton, an alien who comes to Earth to find water for his people and slowly falls prey to humanity's vices, even as he becomes a wealthy magnate. Bowie, who claimed in interviews that his recollections of making the film were clouded by his use of drugs during production, is just about perfect as Newton, seeing how the singer has always had a slightly alien vibe about him to begin with. The film is visually absorbing throughout, although the plot may seem a bit muddled on first viewing. It didn't help either that the original US release was trimmed by around 20 minutes. Ahead of its time, yet very much of its era, The Man Who Fell to Earth, which also inspired a recent TV series, is 70s sci-fi cinema at its most surreal and cerebral. Next is Logan's Run from 1976. Yes, very good film. It's regarded as one of the 1970s sillier sci-fi spectacles in certain quarters, and indeed its big budget visual effects, high concept premise, and box office success might have paved the way for the sci-fi boom that exploded out of Hollywood the following year. But despite some of its cringier acting and dated direction, Logan's Run is still a vastly entertaining picture that takes some sly digs at youth culture, narcissism, and authoritarian government control. And AI, since a supercomputer runs things. Taking large liberties with William F. Nolan and George Clayton Johnson's novel, Logan's Run is set in a domed post-apocalyptic city where everyone's short hedonistic lives, better to keep them distracted, are terminated at age 30. Those who try to escape are runners and are executed by sandmen. One such sandman is Logan Five, played by Michael York, who is sent undercover to find the location of a safe haven called Sanctuary, but becomes a runner himself. It's one fun chase or escape sequence after another, pulpy in the best sense, and why they can't get a remake off the ground after decades of development remains a mystery. But that's okay. We still have the original. Next up is Demon Seed from 1977. Director Donald Cammell takes Dean R. Koontz's cringy, exploitative 1973 novel, in which a computer imprisons a woman in her house and impregnates her with its child, and turns it into something that is perhaps not quite profound, but is at least in some ways thoughtful and interested in more than gratuitous scenes of the computer artificially bringing the woman to orgasm, which can be found in the book. The film is helped a great deal by Julie Christie in the lead, and Fitz Weaver as her estranged husband, the computer's creator who doesn't realise that he's lost his own humanity while building the ultimate AI. It's the implications of what the supercomputer Proteus can do. It basically slips into Christie's house for her own automated computer system, which should make anyone think twice about having Alexa run their home, that makes Demon Seed both prescient and chilling. The movie's ending, in which the child is born, is also properly ambiguous, hinting at either a new level of evolution for humanity or the first portent of its doom. This one is ripe for a revisit, or perhaps even a remake. Next up is Invasion of the Body Snatchers from 1978. So after Star Wars in 1977, which was followed rapidly by Close Encounters of the Third Kind, the Hollywood studios became very interested in making the genre as four-quadrant a draw as possible. This marked a turning point and arguably the end, for a while, of the anything-goes feel of much of 70s sci-fi, although some remarkable work continued to slip through. Chief among them was Philip Kaufman's superb remake of a 1956 classic, based on a novel by Jack Finney, which took familiar genre IP and gave it an entirely new spin. Kaufman correctly moved away from the communist metaphors of the original and turned Body Snatchers into something more insidious, with his pod aliens landing in that most free-thinking of cities, San Francisco, and stamping out all individual thought and emotions. The citizens are so wrapped up in their own selves, so disconnected from meaningful relationships, that the invasion takes place before Donald Sutherland and a small circle of allies begin to notice. The result is a movie steeped in paranoia, filled with frightening imagery, and rightly regarded as one of the best remakes of all time, which is probably why they keep redoing it. And finally is Time After Time from 1979. 3 years before he changed the trajectory of Star Trek history with Star Trek II: The Wrath of Khan, Nicholas Meyer wrote and directed this phantasmagorical romp in which H.G. Wells, played by Malcolm McDowell, invents a time machine in 1893, only for it to be hijacked by Jack the Ripper, played by David Warner, who sends himself to modern-day San Francisco. Wells pursues him to the present, which is not anything like the future he's predicted in his novels, and manages even find romance with a bank teller named Amy, played by Mary Steenburgen, while trying to stop the Ripper from killing again. Mayer's directorial debut has its clunky moments, but the cleverness of the story, the performances from his leads, and the warmth of the relationship between Wells and Amy manage to make this one of the best time travel movies of all time. Light on its feet, full of fun and suspense, Time After Time is certainly not a waste of yours. So there you go. I shall share that there in the chat room for you. Sorry, guys. I was busy reading, so I have not... Sleeper was hilarious. Oh, yeah, Fleece. Yes, Fleece's knowledge is very immense. So Sleeper was hilarious, says Fleece. So we can see what else you've said. There you go. So that's the... first article. I'm going to make a start on this because there's no break at the top of the hour at the moment. Excuse me, I'm just going to mute. Sorry, I just had to take a sip. Yeah, we're staying with Denegeek for this one, but we're getting into the TARDIS and temporarily traversing into the Hooniverse. For this article, authored by Chris Farnell, posted up on June the 9th. And it's debunking Doctor Who urban legends. Daleks. JFK and River Song's Dirty Joke. True or false? We've sought through some of Doctor Who's most persistent myths to separate the fact from the fiction. Let's see how in-depth they are with this one. So much like the Doctor themselves, Doctor Who is a show with a long and eventful history. Various groups and individuals have attempted to track it, but no one person has the entire picture. And even in its official history, there can be contradictions, rumours and stories that grow in the retelling, until they gain a truth all of their own. It's time to address some of the most persistent urban legends and determine just how much truth they have in them. We start off with Daleks are contractually obligated to appear at least once each series. Much like the Daleks themselves, this one keeps coming back. It is common knowledge that the Daleks are not actually the intellectual property of the BBC, but of the estate of their creator, Terry Nation. Perhaps less well known is the fact that Stephen Moffat has a similar arrangement with the Weeping Angels. The Daleks are, of course, the Doctor's most iconic and terrifying enemy. But, fans pipe up, aren't they overused? Haven't we seen too much of the Daleks? Obviously, the theory goes, this cannot simply be because the show's writers want to use a popular recurring villain. The malignant forces of a Terry Nation estate must force the BBC to use the Daleks once per season, or they will lose the rights forever. The first thing to do is check. Have the Daleks actually appeared in every season of a new series? And they have, except that season 6 and season 10 only featured brief cameos by the angry Pepper Potts, and during Chibnall's run, they've been mostly confined to the New Year Day special. Good grief, I've got a break for this one. So anyway, we'll carry on with this after the break. About the Daleks. So, see you in a bit.
You. If you're not in control, then someone else is. Join me, Ivy West, for Voices on the Wind, Saturday. I discuss government, health, metaphysics, suppressed science, universal mysteries, little-known incredible facts, alternative energies, and even more than you can imagine. Won't you join us on Revolution Radio Saturdays? For Voices on the Wind, with me, Ivy West.
There are lives in the balance, people under fire, children at the cannons. There are...
Because if your head's in the sand, your tail is a target.
I am Bill Johnson. Some consider my efforts to be an underground law school. I am not an attorney, and I do not give legal advice. I teach. That's lawful and legal. Consider yourself served. You are to appear Wednesday nights, 10 p.m. Eastern, Studio A. My forte? Foreclosure and contract law. Grab your legal pad and pen. Learn a broad spectrum of law, spanning administrative, criminal, family, tort, and federal law. Fools and losers cling to old cases. I dissect and comment on the latest rulings that control the courts. Don't be a loser. And if you don't appear, you will be held in contempt.
Revolution Radio, every Wednesday, 8 p.m. Eastern Time, on Studio B for Momentary Zen, with host Zen Garcia, at freedomslips.com, the People Station.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to tell you a little bit about Revolution Radio. Revolution Radio brings you a platform unlike anything on the internet today. A place where voices are heard, ideas are shared, and friendships are formed. So why not join the information revolution at freedomslips.com, where information never sleeps.
Thanks for listening while we took that short break here at Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com. And yeah, we're going to get back to your host.
Welcome back to the second hour of the Sunday the 18th of June 2023 edition of Willow's Weekend World. And it's just turned, my name's Willow, by the way, known as Sorry Sunflower, in the Revolution Radio at freedomslips.org chat room. And it's just turned 3 o'clock in the afternoon over here in the UK, which means it's just turned 10 o'clock in the afternoon over on the East Coast, 9 o'clock in the morning, 10 o'clock in the morning over on the East Coast, 9 o'clock in the morning, Central Time, 8 o'clock in the morning, Mountain Time, 7 o'clock in the morning over on the West Coast. In Australia, it's between, I would say, midnight and 2 o'clock in the morning. In New Zealand, it's about 3 in the morning. But wherever you are in the world, I hope that life is being reasonably kind to you. You're not allowing what's unfolding around the world to impact upon you too greatly. Don't let it do that, folks. Don't let it do that. That's all. I'm just looking at what the weather's doing. Could get a bit rumbly. Weather forecast for today, it could get a bit rumbly, folks. Oh, good grief. So anyway, we're back to debunking Doctor Who darkness here. And about the Daleks. Are they obligated to appear in every season? Well, we'll revisit the last paragraph that I did make a start on, which is the first thing to do is check, have the Daleks actually appeared in every season of the new series? And they have, except that season 6 and season 10 only featured brief cameos by the angry Pepper Potts, and during Chibnall's run they've been mostly confined to the New Year's Day specials. It's also worth noting that while Nation's Estate controls the rights to the Daleks, they don't really have anything to do with them but license them to the BBC. Nation himself learned the hard way that there was no demand for a standalone Dalek TV series. Moffat himself has debunked the rumours, saying, "You certainly don't wheel the Daleks out because you've got a contractual obligation to provide Daleks." The main reason the Daleks show up so often, according to Moffat, is that while they might seem to pop up regularly for us, for the show's main audience it is a rare special treat. As Moffat says, for a child, a year between Dalek stories is an eternity. Remember as a kid saying, "Why haven't they done the Daleks for ages? It's been 4 or 5 weeks." Next up is Doctor Who's first episode was delayed by JFK's assassination. If Doctor Who is a show that attracts conspiracy theories, the issue is only compounded by the fact that its first episode coincides with the most conspiracy theory-laden historical event of all time, the assassination of John F. Kennedy the previous day. There are a couple of versions of this legend. Some say that an unearthly child was broadcast 10 minutes later than it was supposed to because of an extended report on the assassination. Others say the delay was caused by the murder of Lee Harvey Oswald, even though that wouldn't happen until the day after. The truth is that an unearthly child was delayed only 1 minute 20 seconds later than its advertised 5:15 p.m. time slot, and that was because Grandstand overran. However, coverage of the assassination did lead to lower than hoped for viewing figures, which led to the pilot being repeated the following week on the 30th of November. Next up is the Dalek name came from an encyclopedia. Dalek is a brilliant word, isn't it? almost perfectly designed for those robotic yet perpetually about to throw a strop voices, dripping with menace. And yet, before 1963, the word had no meaning at all in the English language. It's just some sounds. Terry Nation himself gave a Daily Mirror an origin story for the unusual name, saying he saw some volumes of an encyclopedic dictionary where one volume covered all the entries from Dahl to Lek. It is a story that spread everywhere from the Radio Times to the Oxford English Dictionary. But Doctor Who fans being what we are, it wasn't long before someone smelled a rat. For starters, to cover all the concepts, alphabetically, that an encyclopedia might catalogue between Dahl and Lek would have to be massive. After 10 years, Nation came clean, telling the New Statesman, in a desperate attempt to satisfy persistent journalists who wanted some profound explanation for my naming the Daleks, I told them that I'd been inspired by the letters on a volume of an encyclopedia. But no encyclopedia in print covers those letters Dahl to Lek. Anyone checking the facts could have found me out. The name, it simply rolled off a typewriter. There is another twist in the tale. The word Dalek did exist before 1963 in the Serbo-Croatian language. It means far or far away, distant or maybe even alien. It's strangely appropriate, but Nation never spoke Serbo-Croatian. Next up is the Valyard means the Law Doctor. The Sixth Doctor's era was not a great time for the series, though through no fault of poor Colin Baker. But while the show had some pretty wild missteps, the Fifth Doctor sacrificed himself to save his companion Perry Brown, only for the Sixth Doctor to try to strangle her to death minutes later, it had a few moments where it was ahead of its time. For starters, Colin Baker wanted his Doctor to ditch the more comical attire of the previous couple of Doctors, and instead wear something more like a leather jacket. Instead, he wore a patchwork Technicolor nightmare that has remained the low point for the show's entire 60-year run. But still, the thought was there. It also saw the series switch from its traditional 25-minute episodes to 45-minute stories, a switch that the 2005 series would repeat and make permanent. And finally, the Sixth Doctor attempted one of the most ambitious arcs in the show's history. The Trial of a Time Lord was actually a great idea. A trilogy of standalone Doctor Who adventures, told through the framing device of a Doctor being put on trial by his own people, again, prosecuted by a sinister figure who would turn out to be a darker version of his own future self. As an idea, it's brilliant. It's the sort of thing you could see the show pulling off superbly today. But it has to be said, the execution was pretty pants. But the dark future version of the Doctor himself still stuck in people's minds, and very quickly word spread that his name, the Valyard, actually meant Doctor of Law. It doesn't, though. Once again, the writer hit upon the name Valyard by making it up. It doesn't mean anything. Next up is Riversong's name is a dirty joke. Stephen Moffat, meanwhile, would never disappoint. With a character like River Song, the Doctor's on-again, off-again, dead-again, alive-again wife, it is perhaps not surprising that her name is a dirty joke. As Moffat himself says, Russell and I went through a phase of trying to work out Doctor Who titles with rude acronyms to wind up people on internet message boards. Moffat's contribution was a River Song ending. We'll let you work out the acronym yourselves. Davis responded by asking, what's a River Song? And Moffat replied, I'll just call someone River Song and they'll have to die. That episode would eventually go out under the title The Forest of the Dead. Next up is Ridley Scott almost designed the Daleks. Yes, that Ridley Scott, the director behind such legendary science fiction films as Prometheus and Alien Covenant, started out as a production designer. One of his first gigs, after cutting his teeth on the cop show Z-Cars, was the new sci-fi show Doctor Who, and one of his first assignments, indeed, was to design the villains in the show's second serial. However, shortly before work was due to begin, Scott left behind the BBC in design work to train as a director at Granada Television, leaving Raymond Cusick to take on the job. We're sure he's still kicking himself over that today. Oh, and while we're here, Cusick didn't get the idea for the Daleks from Pepper Potts, but he did use pepper pots to demonstrate how the Daleks would move around. Quickfire round here, casting the next Doctor. So, of course, if you really want to get some Doctor Who urban legends going, the casting of a Doctor themselves is the most fertile ground. So, let's hit as many as we can, as quickly as we can. The magician Paul Daniels was reported to be in the running for the ninth Doctor in 2004. This rumour turned out to be false, with Russell T. Davies instead deciding to cast an actual actor. David Hasselhoff of Baywatch and Knight Rider fame was rumoured to be a potential eighth Doctor in a 90s TV movie, with the name being repeated in the Daily Mirror and the Daily Star, sometimes as Baywatch co-star Pamela Anderson as a companion. However, this was not to be. Colin Salmon, who played the character Dr. Moon in the story that ended up not being called A River Song Ends, actually was intended to be a secret future incarnation of the Doctor. As Moffat wrote in a Doctor Who magazine, somewhere in the terrible future, on a battlefield, the 45th Doctor dies in her arms and makes her the same promise she once made him. It's not over for you, you'll see me again. So River buries her husband and off she goes to have lots of adventure with his younger selves and confuse the hell out of them. Richard Hearne, the Norwich-based comedian, was in the running to replace John Pertwee and became the fourth Doctor, but according to this Barry Letts interview, he didn't get the job as he insisted on playing the Doctor in the style of his own famous character, Mr. Pastry. Chris Marshall. Poor Chris Marshall was never in the running to play the 13th Doctor, eventually played by Jodie Whittaker. However, that didn't stop the entire internet from announcing that they hated the idea when the rumour was first floated. So there you go. There's a few there. I'm sure there's plenty others that I can think of as well. There you go. I'll just post that there in the chat room. There you go. If you can hear some noise behind me, there's a very good reason for it. Mother Nature. Kotaku is up next. Well, we're heading to Kotaku for this one, rather. Author by John Walker was posted up last Monday. And its 16-year-old gamer breaks record for fastest typist in world at 300 words per minute. Spoke to a mythical rocket who just broke the 300 words per minute barrier. Now, has this been confirmed by the Guinness Book of Records? That's what I want to know. But anyway. So honestly, the most extraordinary thing about this 16-year-old breaking the record for typing by hitting over 300 words per minute is that he's ever heard of a keyboard. Shouldn't he be tapping at a phone screen so fast that his thumbs are a fleshy blur? Either way, I bet you didn't know speed typing YouTube was a thing, nor how ridiculously compelling it is to watch. Right, let's lay down some perspective. The average typing speed by us evolved monkeys is around 40 words per minute. However, if you're someone who's looking for, say, secretarial work, you would want to hone your skills until you were hitting 60 or 70 words per minute without making mistakes. Yep, I could do 60, 70. That's more than a word a second. What Florida-based YouTuber Mythical Rocket did last week was breach the previously unbroken record of typing 300 words per minute. That's an eye-watering five times faster than what's considered a good typing speed, and likely the fastest in the world. What's more extraordinary is that Mythical Rocket is only 16 years old. Perhaps even more so, he's only been speed typing for the last 3 years. One of my friends introduced me to this website called Monkey Type, he told me via Twitter DMs, and I just got fascinated with getting higher scores. I took a look at Monkey Type, and it's immediately compelling. It's a super low-key site where you type essentially gibberish sentences made of real words for as long as you fancy, and then it produces data on your words per minute, accuracy and consistency. After 40 years of typing, says the author of this article, starting on a ZX Spectrum in 1984, I achieved 76 words per minute on my first go. I felt very proud, until I asked Mythical Rockets about his first attempts when he was 13. For the 60-second category, I believe my first tests were around 130 to 140 words per minute. So, how? How was a 13-year-old already typing twice as fast as experts at the task? I think the way that I cultivated this speed was through gaming and old Skype Discord text chats. Because it's the internet, there is of course a speed typing community, and Mythical Rocket became known within that space pretty quickly. But, he says, it was only after making TikToks and YouTube videos that there was a following to be found based on this most specific of talents. After being featured on Daily Dose of Internet and Jake Lucky's Twitter page, I think that's when people outside of the typing community started to recognise me, and that's really cool. 300 words per minute has, I'm told, long been thought to be an unbreakable barrier. As Mythical points out, the second highest score behind mine is currently 279 words per minute, which is quite far from 300. However, about a year ago, he says he realised I could be the first one to break it. So often, when boundaries thought to be unbreakable get broken, then all of a sudden others in the field are driven to catch up. So does Mythical Rocket think this will happen within speed typing? There's one person I'm worried about right now, and he goes by Izanagi. He's the guy in second place with a 279. Looks like he's putting a lot of effort into typing right now and might snipe my record. I had to ask the obvious question, even though, honestly, I think just being incredibly good at something is more than enough reason to enjoy doing it. But is there a practical use for a skill like this in his future? I haven't looked too much into practical applications of typing fast, he tells me. And honestly, that's the answer I hoped for. Nor should he. God knows, something like transcription is a brutal job to do for a living. He also adds an extremely astute point. For me, it isn't too helpful, since the thinking process of brain will always be the bottleneck, no matter how fast I can type. Yeah, 300 words per minute is pretty good. I think that's a fair. Yeah, I think it's a fairer speed there. There you go. I should just post that there in the chat room. Yeah, I've heard of Witchfinder General, the band. Yep. I have indeed heard of them. 1970s. Fleece is just talking about them in the chat room. Anyway, we're journeying to that galaxy somewhere far, far away from this article by Gizmodo. And we're celebrating an anniversary, indeed, of Return of the Jedi with this article authored by James Whitbrook. It was posted up on May the 26th. And it's 40 great things about Return of the Jedi. As the climax of the original Star Wars trilogy turns 40, well, it did turn 40 that week, we celebrate, he says, exactly that amount of things that rule about it. So this is about the film, ostensibly. Maybe some other little bits and pieces being thrown in there. But yet, 40 years ago, well, that particular week, Star Wars ended. Well, it ended for a bit. As theatregoers sat down for the climactic battle in Return of the Jedi. Star Wars might have continued beyond it for many more of those 40 years, rather. But still, here's 40 little things we love about the swan song of the original trilogy, in no particular order, just to be celebratory instead of nitpicky. So first up is Leia's hair. Whether it's the messy loose bun as Boosh, the braided high pony in Jabba's palace, her mission braids on Endor, or even her forest princess look when she lets her hair down in Bright Tree Village, there's not a moment in Jedi where Leia isn't serving. Next up is Luke with the Chanel boots. Because of course you can get them anywhere, can't you? So he's a Jedi, like his father before him. More on that later. But also like Anakin Skywalker, Luke knows how to make a statement. The all-black look is iconic for a reason. But the statement? His iconic shiny booties. The Jedi Order could never. Yep, you can get Chanel everywhere, can't you? Lapti neck and Jedi rocks. Indeedy. Sure, the special edition of Return of the Jedi isn't 40 this week, but no matter which way you prefer your jazz bangers, Lapti neck and Jedi rock both rule. Han beaning an officer with his detonator charges. That guy had a real rough day even before Fuzzballs murdered all his friends. Next up is Han and Leia's reunion. might be short-lived, but Leia swooping in like the lead of a romance to dramatically reveal her identity as Boosh and kiss Han after freeing him from Carbonite is so dreamy. Indeedy. And the end nums a little laugh. I can't replicate it. Luke's flippy trick. Long before we had the Jedi of the prequels pirouetting through the air like wizard of acrobats, we had this as the fanciest move in the sacred Jedi text. And honestly, more Jedi springboarding, please. The chumptastic death of Boba Fett. We now know at this point Boba eventually claws his way out of being Sarlacc dinner, but still, what a comedy of errors for the supposedly meanest, baddest bounty hunter around. His little flail on hand sends him flying. They thunk against Jabba's sail barge. His little roll to doom. What a goose. Next up is the Mon Calamari that can't find his monitor. Happens to the best of us. It's stressful going into battle to decide the fate of a known galaxy. Luke going berserker mode. So Luke's duel with Vader is an excellent set of sequences, showing how far Luke has come since Empire. But you know that boy is Darth Vader's kiddo when, after being force-goaded into the Dark Lord, sensing that Luke has a sister he could turn to the dark side, Luke takes the proverbial gloves off and goes ham. Oh, good grief. Because he's holding a thermal detonator! First of all, big negotiation flex by Leia here. Second of all, C-3PO, you drama queen. This cool skull effect when Vader's being electrocuted. Oh, look at that. Sure, it's painful enough that it helps kill him. But still, there's something awesome and horrifying about seeing Vader's skull crackle and light up through the Emperor's Force lightning as Anakin decides to switch sides. The Tears of Malakili. The Rancor fight is a compelling sequence all of its own, but there's something so very Star Wars in the idea that this creature we've already seen devour multiple people horrifically, and only brutally slain before we could do so to our main hero, elicits such a bittersweet emotional denouement as Malakili, the Rancor Keeper, rushes out to his dead ward, overcome with grief. Next up is an A-Wing doing something useful for once. A-Wings suck. A-Wings suck slightly less when, in the process of sucking, they luckily manage to take down a Superstar Destroyer. Feral Ewoks. Say what you will about the merchandiseification of Star Wars by adding kiddie teddy bears. Actually, don't. That's a stupid argument for a franchise that understood merchandising from the very beginning and changed the game forever in the process. But there is still something so awesome about seeing adorable Ewoks just absolutely butcher stormtroopers in a flurry of rocks, spears and stone axes. As all good teddy bears do. I see you have constructed a new lightsaber. This is already a fantastic sequence, setting up Luke and Vader's evolution since their last meeting, one that is only made all the more resonant with the later context of the prequels and seeing renowned tinkerer Anakin Skywalker examine his child's handiwork. But it's all just an excuse to gush about how cool Luke's own saber is. The Obi-Wan influence in the design, the iconic green blade, it's one of the best around. General Madeen's little stick here. God bless you, Crix Madeen, for providing generations of action figures of politicians, diplomats, officers, and other general non-combatant Star Wars characters the gift of the you are necessary, when you just can't give them a blaster. What is the stick for? Who knows? But Kenner and Hasbro certainly don't mind it all these years later. Next up is B-Wings. We don't really get to see B-Wings actually do much in their debut here, but even then, the shot of them lining up to lock S-foils in attack position is an awesome mirror to the X-Wings doing so in A New Hope. Fantastic design and much better than some other Rebel starfighters introduced here. R2-D2's pop-up lightsaber action feature. Once again, action figure makers were blessed for generations with R2's surprise way of getting his master his lightsaber from across the great pit of Carcoon. A spring-loaded surprise yeet. Ackbar said the thing. We're talking about how the Rebel fleet can't withstand firepower of that magnitude, of course. Nothing about the good Admiral finding himself ensnared in some kind of ambush. Pruneface. Okay, they're Dresselians, but when you've got a prune for a face, Kenner's going to call you prune face when you inevitably get an action figure, and it's going to stick. Sorry, Ari Marco. That's Gungan that shouts, we are free, in the extended victory celebration. Once again, the special editions aren't 40 this year, but there is something completely hilarious about the extended version of the galaxy celebrating Palpatine's death when we get cut to Theed, the capital city of the former Senator's homeworld, and we loudly hear a random Gungan celebrating. Yeah, buddy, yous are free. Bideo Quirv is up next, so the most powerful skull in all of Star Wars, so worthy of the expanded universe, simply had to give him a full backstory, which, naturally, involved meeting Han Solo at some point. Wicket meets Leia. Warwick Davis's proper debut in Return of a Jedi is a masterclass in making an instantly adorable character. So much fun in this small moment, as we see Leia's empathy and bonding with the wary Ewok, and then immediately teaming up the second they realise that they're not a threat to each other. His little spear. The kick whiffed around the world. Oh, yeah, so it does. Star Wars fans nitpick over the smallest flub detail, or, frankly, literally anything. But Luke's iconic, perhaps even Force-assisted, kick when he's fighting off Jabba's goons on the skiffs is the flub everyone loves. Well, that and the stormtrooper that bonks his head on the door in A New Hope. But we're not celebrating A New Hope today. Next up is the unmasking of Darth Vader. We had glimpses of what could be under Vader's mask in Empire, but there's something still so potent about Luke tenderly removing his father's mask to reveal the ravaged man beneath the horrifying visage. At this point, Vader is broken, on his path to redemption, and preparing to breathe his last and say goodbye to his son. And seeing his true self is still such a powerful climax to the film. The Ewok's sad about his friend's death. A lot of the Endor ground battle is about watching Ewoks absolutely beat the snot out of the Empire in various ways, but victory has a price, and the one actual explicit on-screen Ewok death we get in Jedi is incredibly sad. Why won't they just get up, damn it? Sniff. Next up is Star Wars Storytime is C-3PO. God telling his devout followers a mythological tale of good and evil is very Star Wars side fantasy, even before you get to the fact that it's C-3PO telling a bunch of Ewoks the plot of A New Hope and Empire Strikes Back. What makes it even better is that, as a droid, and also a bitch with a flair for drama, he naturally accentuates his storytelling by playing his Star Wars sound bank when needed. The TIE Swarm is up next, so the trap is sprung on the Rebel fleet in an awesome, horrifying moment as the Death Star 2's laser lances through a cruiser. But one of the coolest shots in the whole sequence, which is non-stop cool shots in the franchise's best space battle, is our perspective in the Falcon cockpit as the whole wing of TIE interceptors and fighters swarms over the Rebel squadrons. Short, sweet, and full of that iconic TIE shriek. Next up is Ian McDiarmid having the time of his life. The Emperor appeared in Empire, but the Emperor became the Emperor when Ian McDiarmid stepped in for Return of a Jedi, delivering a gloriously meaty, campy, and yet still menacing term with relatively little screen time. A cackle so good, they've just kept him returning somehow. Many Bothans here, so such a small line, with such weight. Little did Caroline Blackiston know that Mon Mothma's lamenting the loss of many unseen alien lives to get the Death Star plans would result in one of Star Wars' most fascinating side stories, and an alien species that, despite the fact we haven't actually seen one in generations, became vital to the fabric of the old expanded universe. Single-handedly responsible for giving us a complete magnificent bastard that is Borsk failure. Wedge landing the Death Star 2 kill. So Wedge Antilles always rules, but there's something so satisfying in it being his X-Wing that lands the killing blow on the Death Star 2, after he was forced to duck out of the original trench run assault in A New Hope. Next up is I Love You. I know, Redux. Star Wars loves it when the poetry rhymes, and taking Empire's iconic romantic declaration and turning it into a sly moment for Han and Leia as the latter prepares to surprise the trooper, sneaking up behind the former with her blaster, is just delightful. Salacious B. Crumb is up next, as Star Wars also loves it when there's a little freak, and they rarely get as little or freaky as Salacious B. Crumb. It's very freaky. The scout trooper that gets owned by a tree stump. That's what you'd get for looking over your shoulder in a high-speed chase, sucker. Hutslayer layer, so we love it when hashtag feminism is actually hashtag choke a horny slug to death, don't we, folks? Obi-Wan's Force Ghost having a sit-down. So Obi-Wan Kenobi is a very good liar. He's a master of life after death and the will of a cosmic force. He's also a ghost that needs a sit-down. And that's just very funny. Coming to the last two now, Han and Lando hanging out, literally. So after the whole "so you sold me out to the Empire and got me turned into a flash freeze ready meal" situation left Han and Lando's relationship, well, frosty, they immediately slide back into their friendly banter during the sail barge fight, as the still blinded Han tries to get Lando to trust his aim to save a dangling space dandy from being nibbled on by the Sarlacc. It's so funny. Next up is Vader's pyre. A lot of the moments on this list are very goofy or light-hearted, but it's fitting that Vader gets many of Jedi's most emotional moments. It is, essentially, the story of his redemption in death as much as it is the victory of the rebellion. And there are a few moments more somber than Luke slipping away from the joyous celebrations with the Ewoks to bid a spiritual farewell to his father, a bittersweet bond formed in the flames of Anakin's funeral pyre. And finally, he says, "I'm a Jedi like my father before me." We said this list is unordered, and by and large it is. But we saved this for last simply because it is the moment of Return of a Jedi. It's arguably the moment of Star Wars. The ultimate rejection of evil, the faith Luke has in himself and in his father, the most triumphant blow against the Sith is not done with some grand act of Force wizardry or with the blade of a lightsaber. Instead, we see that the weapon tossed aside as Luke declares himself to be the ideal the Jedi should be. Not fighting what they hate, but saving what they love. So, excuse me, I'm just going back to the beginning so I can share it in the chat room for you. There we go. There's a lot of good. There you go. Oh, I don't know. Mark Hamill plays an incredible Joker. He voices the Joker in, I can't remember which one, but I do remember Breyer actually saying that was one of his favourite Mark Hamill roles, as opposed to Luke Skywalker, when he played a very, very chilling Joker. Hold on a moment. I'll look this one up, because there's comments about him being typecast in the chat room. Maybe. It's one of the third. Yeah, he played voiced the Joker in Batman the Animated Series, and was very good, apparently, because I know Breyer actually watched it, and he said he was very good. Anyway, we're returning to Den of Geek for this article, authored by, good grief, apologies for the pronunciation here, George Chrysostomou. It was posted up on June the 10th. And it's Barbie, Transformers, and Hollywood's rocky history of toy brand movies. Yeah, it's always pretty difficult to translate across, isn't it? So toy lines are having a big summer between new Transformers and Barbie films, but it wasn't always so. We explore the evolution of toys turned film. So Hollywood is always looking for the next big source of entertainment. Right now, it seems that video game adaptations are finally on the verge of legitimacy due to the success of the Super Mario Brothers movie, and HBO's The Last of Us. Before that, it was superhero movies. And on it goes. However, the industry's endless search for intellectual property has for decades led to false starts and brief flirtations with the world of toys and board games. When looking across the chronology of those attempts, a few key flaws stand out as to why the concept has still yet to catch on quite as strongly as comic books or video games. Adaptations of products are notoriously difficult to get right, because they are not necessarily attached to a narrative that people know. The basic premise of a toy's brand might be established, but who those characters are and what that world looks like has yet to be filled in. By design, key narrative elements to build a story around are left vague, and for a child's imagination to fill in. Yet, with the upcoming release of Greta Gerwig's Barbie, not to mention the seventh Transformers movie, here's an opportunity for the medium to evolve. But what can Mattel learn about toy and game adaptations from the past before they take their fashion icon to the big screen? To know that, we have to start at the beginning. First film was Clue from 1985. Yeah, I remember, I was just thinking about the Cluedo film. So before many modern toy-based adaptations came, this board game cult hit from the 1980s. Based on the murder mystery experience that had been dubbed Cluedo internationally, director Jonathan Lynn's Clue worked on a minuscule budget of $15 million. But with barely any storyline, besides a mysterious homicide and a few notable character names, it seemed impossible for the filmmakers to create a compelling adaptation that would both amuse audiences and inspire product sales. Perhaps it's Clue's lack of corporate focus that paid off, at least creatively. The movie never felt as if it was trying to sell anything, and instead used the board game as a blueprint for a satire of whodunit mysteries. Its hilarious cast and reframing as a dark comedy ensured that the outside-the-box approach paid off. This wasn't a paint-by-numbers exercise, but instead a genuine creative endeavour that took risks and worked within its own boundaries. Fast-paced and witty dialogue from writers Lynn and John Landis brought the screen's scenes to life and gave personalities to characters that players previously had to make up. It was the correct balance of taking advantage of those grey areas and paying homage to the elements that board game enthusiasts enjoyed. Clue ultimately worked because it knew what it wanted to be from the start. Next up is Masters of the Universe from 1987. So although toys had inspired big screen spectacles before the release of Masters of the Universe, this live-action outing from director Gary Goddard is definitely an early standout of the action figure age. He-Man and the Masters of the Universe had already begun as an animated series in 1982, inspired by the Mattel toys. Although looking back on the show now, it may seem dated, the series did help to establish plenty of fun and wacky characters that kids just had to own. It was a roaring success, and plenty of fans are still nostalgic about that initial run. It stood to reason that it would garner a big screen recreation, but arguably the era it was made in let it down. Masters of the Universe was simply too ambitious of a project to really work without the technology and filmmaking techniques of the 1980s. Although it could be argued that classics like Star Wars from 1977 had already been created, the narrative behind the He-Man franchise simply wasn't strong enough to survive the limited execution afforded such properties in the 80s, especially by the Cannon Group. The charismatic Dolph Lundgren taking on the lead role of He-Man didn't hurt the movie's chances. But the script barely resembled the animated show due to those budgetary and technological concerns. Additionally, the narrative depth of the animated series wasn't complex enough to actually sustain being drawn out to feature-length production, which only exacerbated issues further. The solution Cannon came up with, setting the majority of the movie in suburbia with He-Man being a fish out of water, didn't help matters. The lesson here is therefore twofold: to have the capabilities to produce an ambitious adaptation and enough story to fill it. Next up is Toy Story from 1995. The revolution in toy-based movie making, ironically enough, came from an original property. Toy Story was, of course, an original concept from the then-fledgling Pixar Animation Studios. It was their first feature film. Yet it was also packed to the brim with actual toy brands that interacted with original characters. By extension, those characters were based on archetypes from the toy-making industry, but director John Lasseter and the rest of the Pixar team took the opportunity to distance themselves from any one individual product line. The movie was, of course, a massive hit and defined the computer animation moving forward, and it taught other toy-inspired adaptations an important lesson. Despite the lead characters being inanimate objects, they were still displaying very human emotions. And that includes the ones who were based on real products. Hasbro's Mr. Potato Head, Plastic Army Men, and even Mattel's Barbie. Compared to Clue and Masters of the Universe, the movie wasn't trying to turn toys into real people. Instead, it made the toys themselves feel real because of their conflicts and relationships. That made Toy Story far more relatable and emotionally moving. Toy Story 2 from 1999, Toy Story 3 from 2010, and Toy Story 4 from 2019, all built on that same quality. Toys had to worry about things that the audience would have never experienced. getting sent to a museum, losing their owner to college, or getting replaced by a new toy. But the core principles of those feelings were instantly recognisable. Bratz from 2007 is up next, so Bratz is another example of everything that could go wrong with a toy adaptation. Although the characters had personalities that were relatively defined through the products, mainstream audiences simply didn't know who each individual Brat was. The film, which was directed by Sean McNamara, very much took a Mean Girls or Legally Blonde style of approach. In making those decisions, the film couldn't decide who its audience was. In its premise, perhaps teen girls would have been the right demographic. But Bratz as a brand appealed to a slightly younger market. Artistically, Bratz cannot be compared to the risks that Clue took or the emotional depth that Toy Story produced. Just like Masters of the Universe, this is a concept that was stretched to its limits. With even less story to draw from, a plot revolving around a war against the school principal left the intellectual property floundering. In the years since, Bratz has been far more successful in the short-form animated world, with the younger audience as its key demographic. That's where this brand thrives. Perhaps the film's biggest crime is that it's generic. It could have been based on literally anything. Successes in the toy industry certainly aren't based on the notion of being average and plain. Next up is Transformers from 2007. It's fair to say that the evolution of the Transformers movies could warrant an article unto themselves. With Rise of the Beasts now in theatres, it's no surprise that the Transformers franchise has hugely influenced modern toy-based adaptations. From a financial perspective, the series has produced some of the biggest successes. Michael Bay's first attempt at the franchise proved to be imaginative, huge in its scope and scale, and appealing to mainstream audiences. It was a good introduction to the world, and while it might not have been everyone's cup of tea, it at least took the series in a new direction. Especially for teenagers with its premise, switching to a boy buying a Transformer car to impress a girl. To Transformers' benefit, there was a huge wealth of material to inspire future stories, thanks to the comics and animated shows. This didn't just feel like the elongation of a concept inspired by some plastic. It was instead the growth of a fictional universe, putting a fresh coat of paint on some much-loved narrative beats and characters. But in the Transformers sequels, any heart was cut out of the juggernaut. From a quality perspective, there were diminishing returns. Nothing could capture the magic of seeing those robotic warriors in a real sequence for the first time. Although the battles got bigger and the lore-based cuts got deeper, audiences began to move away from the series. Hardcore fans certainly weren't being catered to, but by the time Transformers The Last Knight struck in 2017, it was obvious something had to change. Bumblebee from 2018 was supposed to be the cure to the plague of apathy. It wasn't as concerned with huge explosions and ridiculous humour. It instead told a personal story of a girl and her car that just so happened to be an alien robot. It respected the source material, but brought in its own artistic flair. Director Travis Knight had a clear vision, and lead Hayley Steinfeld was the perfect grounded foil to the over-the-top world she was about to step into. Bumblebee is a showcase of learning from the chronology of toy-based movie making and going back to basics with a human narrative that also includes a toy. Alas, it also wasn't a hit, hence the back-to-basics pivot in Rise of the Beasts. Next up is G.I. Joe, The Rise of Cobra from 2009. G.I. Joe, The Rise of Cobra and Snake Eyes from 2021 were essentially born from the Transformers methodology. Hit the audience with a lot of noise and action, forget the need for any true character growth, and throw in a few fun references to old lore. It's a strategy that woefully failed, still angering diehard fans while never fully finding its mainstream crowd. Although G.I. Joe Retaliation from 2013 attempted to course correct with a slightly closer adaptation to the toys, comics and animated shows, it just wasn't enough. At least a cast overhaul and directorial change from Stephen Summers to John M. Chu didn't remove the sour taste that the 2009 entry left in the mouth. Still, G.I. Joe adaptations have continued to lack heart. Every iteration has been displayed as the start of a new shared universe. a concept that jaded moviegoers roll their eyes at, considering the franchise just simply hasn't earned it. There are years of compelling stories to tell, but with the live-action versions largely hell-bent on ignoring the best ones, it's difficult to see how the toy adaptation is ever going to take off. Next up is Battleship from 2012. The less said about Battleship, the better. Directed by Peter Berg, the game-based adaptation is from the same school of thought as G.I. Joe and Transformers. In fact, there were rumours of a larger shared universe being developed that would try to cross these Hasbro properties over. The cynical development style, which put toys selling and blockbuster building above story, can be traced to Battleship's inevitable downfall. Perhaps part of the problem was that there was no narrative of Battleship to begin with. It turns a naval war game inspired by the Second World War into a lazy run-of-the-mill alien invasion flick in the post-Independence Day mould. The idea that aliens could be thrown into the mix just to make the movie seem even more cinematic, or at least indistinguishable from other 2000s blockbusters, was ridiculous. With no true direction and nothing to say, the only reason behind this adaptation was financial. Upon its initial announcements, fans had a sinking feeling, and they were right. Next up is the Lego Movie from 2014. The Lego Movie was a perfect encapsulation of every lesson that had been learned through years of trial and error in the genre. The movie relied upon the Lego product to create humour and spark narrative. But it was inventive and original. It blended live action and animation together to allow the toys to feel authentic. They're literally toys. It also took the idea of play and turned it on its head, somehow churning out intelligent thematic commentary on control, fascism, and groupthink. Directors Phil Lord and Chris Miller ensured that the Lego Movie appealed to its target demographic of kids with its vibrant visuals and whimsical humour. But its adult storytelling ensured that all ages could enjoy it too. Although the Lego Movie 2 from 2019 might have been a slight step down from its predecessor, it nonetheless delivered on many of those same beats. But it was the Lego Batman Movie in 2017 from director Chris McKay that shocked audiences the most. Its meta-humour could only be achieved thanks to the Lego product, and it completely broke down Batman as a character and all the tropes of his cinematic outings. This is a case of a toy actually elevating another IP and allowing a story to be told that simply wouldn't work in any other format. The Lego Batman Movie and the original brick-based release are both strong indications of the potential of toy adaptations and how their narratives can be used to say something unique. Next up is Trolls from 2016. DreamWorks Animation's Trolls franchise might just be the anomaly. From a quality perspective, the two films in the series thus far are lacking. And yet, the box office and family appeal has outshone many other toy-based adaptations. Trolls, which was directed by Mike Mitchell and Trolls World Tour from Walt Dern, found a formula and stuck to it. They feature over-the-top animation, a vibrant colour palette, silly humour, and bizarre character archetypes. Somehow, these elements came together to convey the essence of what the Trolls toys are for kids. The franchise found its audience and stuck to it. Trolls and its sequel certainly didn't attempt to convey a larger thematic message, nor did the two films lose sight of the product that got them commissioned. The duo break all the rules and come out the better for it. But when the lead characters are fantastical creatures that hug and dance and sing all day long, there really isn't any other direction to go in. Trolls Band Together shows no signs of departing from that ideology and will continue to showcase the wackiness of a toy brand regardless of what critics think. And finally is Barbie from 2023. The upcoming release of Barbie appears to be taking away the most important message from the successes and failures of past adaptations. It's letting the toys be toys while allowing the plastic figure to interact with the real world. It seems to have found its audience, aiming at older viewers who remember having Barbies in their younger years. It also seems to be saying something deeper, carrying a message about identity and breaking away from conformity. Its narrative might be inspired by the Barbie everyone knows, but it's also obviously breaking off in its own direction. For future toy and board game adaptations to work, they need to carry the flavour and feel of the product, and respect its lore while moving to a new narrative that actually has a purpose. It's taken years of releases to finally get a formula that works. So, there you go. I'll just show that. I think the Lego films are fantastic. Very well done. There you go. I'll just post that there in the chat room. I think I've got time for one more article. And then what I'm going to do is I'm going to defer the 15 action movies that were ahead of their time article to a later show, because I am going to be covering for Lizzie. And I want to try to stick to the feel of Lizzie's show for that hour. I think I've got time for this one, maybe. I'm just checking to see the length. Yeah, I should have time for this one. So, yeah, final article for today, for this bit of a show, is from Den of Geek, authored by Joe George, posted up on June the 9th, and it's Star Trek Strange New World Season 2 will show us a Captain Kirk we haven't seen before. Sorry, it's a good job I was muted then. Paul Wesley joins the main cast of Star Trek Strange New Worlds as Lieutenant James T. Kirk, but he's a very different version of the captain we know so well. When you think of James Tiberius Kirk, captain of USS Enterprise, what words come to mind? Brash? Heroic? Romantic? All of those words apply, thanks to decades worth of performances by William Shatner and the younger version Chris Pine played in the J.J. Abrams Star Trek films. With Strange New World Season 2, we'll get yet another take on Kirk, this one courtesy of Paul Wesley. We got a hint of Wesley's Kirk in the Season 1 finale of Strange New Worlds, but that was from an alternate reality where he never became captain of the Enterprise. In a recent press junket via Trek Movie, Wesley gave a few more details about how his younger Kirk will differ from not only the man he played in Season 1, but also the Shatner and Pine Kirks we know so well. In many ways, I think Kirk is still a boy, at least in the version that I sort of been playing, Wesley explained. Not sure he understands how to be a captain yet. From that description, Wesley's Kirk sounds similar to that of Pine's, at least as he's portrayed in 2009 Star Trek. But in the Kelvin timeline, Kirk was a wayward youth after his father died on the USS Kelvin. As it takes place in the Prime timeline, this Kirk didn't have the same family background or the weight of expectation, which allows him to gradually grow into his role. I'd like to slowly begin to portray him as someone with a deep confidence and an unwavering sort of sense of who he is, said Wesley. But I don't think he's quite there yet. And I think that's sort of what makes it so sort of special to watch. Part of that development includes Kirk's relationship with the person who has always been and always will be his friend, Mr. Spock. The early tension between Spock and Kirk was a driving force in the 2009 Star Trek film, a precursor to the close bond the two shared throughout the original series and the subsequent movies. For Ethan Peck, those stories give fertile ground to the adversarial component of Kirk and Spock's relationship, and maybe we will, maybe we won't take on the friendship. Wesley concurs with Peck's take, noting that although we viewers have high expectations of the friendship the two will share, Kirk and Spock do not. I think what's great is that they don't know what their friendship is going to be yet, he enthused. They really don't know what it is about one another that is alluring or intriguing. As these comments show, Wesley's Kirk continues the approach to the series that Strange New Worlds co-creator and co-showrunner Akiva Goldsman described in an exclusive interview with Den of Geek magazine. Season 1 was, if you really think about it, kind of an experiment, he said. So, because we got such a great response from people out there in the world, our brief for Season 2 became, let's do Season 1, but bigger and better. That bigger and better will include taking Kirk to places he's never been before, only further enriching our understanding of Trek's greatest captain. So anyway, folks, I'm going to take a little bit of a break. This is the end of the, well, this is the end of today's Willow's Weekend World Show, because I am going to try to stick to the spiritual essence of Lizzie's show for the third hour. My third hour the first for that and only. So go and get yourselves a cup of tea, cup of coffee. I'll be back after the break. Going to be looking at some reincarnation cases that I started talking about on Thursday on my show. So see you in a bit.
This is Thomas, a.k.a. a Mad Painter. I'd like you to join me Monday nights, 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time for Open Canvas. Don't forget to bring an open mind.
Yes, folks, that's right. Bring an open mind to an open canvas. Again, that is Monday nights, 10 p.m. Eastern. UFOs to government corruption. This is Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com. You don't need to expect us. We're already here.
Don't miss the Crypt Rick and Jonathan Show every Saturday, 6 to 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, Studio B, right here at Revolution Radio.
The journey begins to fun, health, and freedom.
This is the people's war. It is our war. We are the fighters. Fight it, then. Fight it with all that is in us. And may God defend the right.
Warning! Warning!
We've got to stop them! They're going to kill us all!
See how the trouble you've started?
Be they the government, be they industry, be they organized labor, be they anyone, or human beings.
Time when the operation of the machine becomes so odious, makes you so sick at heart. But you can't take part. You can't even passively take part. And you've got to put your bodies upon the gears and upon the wheels, upon the levers, upon all the apparatus, and you've got to make it stop. And you've got to win the day to the people who run it, to the people who own it. That unless you're free, the machine will be prevented from working.